from Bach's choral prelude Ich rufe dir, Herr Jesu Christ. Andrei Tarkovsky opened his classic 1972 movie Solaris with it, and my guest today on All in the Mind uses it to reflect on the emotional and spiritual needs of the psyche. Gone with the Wind, Eat Your Heart Out. Today on Radio National Summer, I've got a grand and provocative saga of vast proportion for you. Vast, but also deeply intimate, because it's cast across the history of Western civilization, but also inside the crevices of your brain. Dr. Ian McGilchrist started out as a scholar in English literature and philosophy. His second career, though, saw him become a leading consultant psychiatrist and clinical director at the Bethlehem and Maudsley Hospital in London. His latest book is something of a magnum opus. You can tell by its title, The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World. At its heart is a warning about the way we live. There's a reason we have two hemispheres of the brain, he says. It's because we need both versions of the world. Well, Ian McGilchrist, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us from London.
Thank you very much.
Your account, Ian, of where Western civilization has arrived at is a dark one. It's a pessimistic one. You suggest that we, and these are your words, occupy an increasingly fragmented, decontextualized world marked by unwarranted optimism mixed with a feeling of emptiness. And this is a dark conception of the world. What prompted you to turn to the brain for an explanation, when others might instead turn to social and economic shifts?
Yes, I don't think it was really that I was turning to the brain for an explanation of those social changes, the changes in our culture and the structure of our civilization even, but in fact that whole perspective that there's a greater reality by accounting for things at the brain level is one that I would be sceptical of. Instead, it's more trying to suggest that there are two broad takes on the world, if you like, and that what I learnt about differences between the hemispheres suggests that these actually underwrite two competing ways of being in the world and thinking about the world, only one of which we seem capable of entertaining these days.
And that's the left hemisphere view. But for you, the brain has very much played a role in creating the world we occupy. It doesn't just experience the world, it generates it.
That's right. That my idea is that the world is something that isn't exactly given before we experience it, but also isn't just something our brains or minds make up. It's a coming together of whatever it is outside of us with our minds, and that in the process of the two meeting, there's a sort of what I call betweenness, which brings things into being. And depending on which mode of attention we bring to bear on the world, a different sort of world will come into being.
Let's come to the title of this book, The Master and His Emissary. It draws from a lamentation on your behalf about the status of modern society.
Yes, it's very loosely based on a little story in Nietzsche about a wise spiritual master who is the head of a small community which flourishes under his care and grows in size to the point where he can't actually look after it all himself. So he needs to have an emissary that he trusts. And his most trusted and gifted emissary is sent off to get on with business in the further flung parts of the domain. And I think an important point is that the master realizes he can't actually get involved with that and can't know those things. In fact, not only can't, but shouldn't know what's going on there. He must deputize that to the emissary, otherwise it would jeopardize what he's able to do. And I think this is, in a way, an image of what the relationship between the right and the left hemispheres. The right hemisphere sees a great deal, but in order to refine it and to make sense of it in certain ways, in order to be able to use what it understands of the world and to be able to manipulate the world, it needs to delegate the job of simplifying it and turning it into a usable form to another part of the brain. And if that brain, that part of the brain, was actually attending to it in the same way as the other part, they wouldn't be able to achieve this double act, if you like. And in the story, what happens is that the emissary feels that he's actually the one that's doing all the hard work here and doesn't really need the master, who's just an irrelevance. And through his sort of pride and short-sightedness, the community collapses and fails.
So the emissary betrays the master, and in this
way
you're seeing the master as the right hemisphere and the emissary as the left hemisphere,
yes,
in today's world. Now, what's gone wrong with today's world?
The way that metaphor works in the modern world is that the right hemisphere, from all that we know of neuroscience, conceives the world in a certain sort of a way, which is primary, and we mustn't lose sight of it. But the left hemisphere has a narrow, decontextualized and theoretically based model of the world, which is self-consistent and is therefore quite powerful. And it becomes more important in the modern world. It seems to have taken over. There seems to be a process whereby its vision has become the only vision, and the vision that would be possible through the right hemisphere has been undercut and excluded. There are a number of reasons why that might happen. I mean, the first is that, as I say in the book, I call the left hemisphere the Berlusconi of the brain, because it controls the media. It's the one that with which we do all our talking and arguing. But also, it's fascinating in looking at the way in which the two hemispheres mutually inhibit one another across the corpus callosum, the band of tissue at the base of the brain through which they're connected. And the function of the corpus callosum is to convey information, but very largely to inhibit the other hemisphere from acting when one of them is active.
Mm.
So there's a constant reciprocal interaction between them. But the fascinating thing is that the left hemisphere is better able to inhibit the right than the right is to inhibit the left.
Right, so it's in a sense dominant.
So it's dominant in that way, even though in terms of the importance of what it can tell us, it's secondary. The other thing is the left hemisphere's system, as I say, is self-consistent in a simplified way.
So it can delude itself.
And so it can delude itself that it knows everything, whereas I see the right hemisphere as seeing things that lie beyond what we ourselves conceive. So it's all the time, as it were, grasping or trying to grasp, reaching out towards something that is beyond us.
And in this way, you suggest that the right hemisphere is our bullshit detector. It's more in touch with reality. But on what scientific basis do you...
Well, there's a lovely piece of research by Deglin and Kinsbourne, two quite prominent neuroscientists. They asked the same questions to individuals with both their hemispheres intact and working, with just the left hemisphere functioning and with just the right hemisphere functioning. There are ways of temporally inactivating one hemisphere or the other, and what is extraordinary is that when completely false propositions are put to the left hemisphere, it accepts them as valid because the internal structure of the argument is valid. So, the individual who has previously said this can't be right says, well, that's what it says on this bit of paper. The right hemisphere, on the other hand, cries out, this can't possibly be right. I know from experience this isn't correct. And that's much closer to the position that we adopt actually when we've got both our hemispheres working. And that's how we detect that this is most probably not right.
Let's come to the contemporary world, because, you think it's come about through what you describe as the unopposed action of a dysfunctional left hemisphere, that in effect we've entered a phase in cultural history where the left hemisphere has all the cards and looks set to win the game. Is that more than a metaphor in your mind?
Yeah, I think it is more than a metaphor, in that it's at least my very real conception, concern about the way our culture in the West is heading, and I think it's shared by a lot of people, which is that it's a rationalistic rather than reasoned or reasonable and mechanistic model of who we are and of the world that we inhabit, which is based on a relationship of exploitation. The left hemisphere is there to help us use and manipulate the world, has come to displace a sense of ourselves as in connection with the world and playing an important reciprocal role with one another and with the planet on which we live. So I think it has a very real meaning for where we're heading now, both in terms of the increasing abstraction, bureaucratization and technicalizing of our lives, and a sort of paranoia in which we can't trust one another anymore and have to monitor absolutely everything, versus a richer and more interconnected sort of vision of the world.
And this you cast as very much a left hemisphere way of framing our world,
yes,
and
yes,
viewing the world.
Yes. And one of the fascinating things is that if you look at what happens to people when they have a stroke in the right hemisphere, a very, very usual phenomenon is that people underestimate or even deny the extent of their disability. As I say in the book, the left hemisphere is an eternal optimist. It's constantly believes in itself to a degree which is unsound. And that means in terms of the patient that they may deny that they've got a paralysis altogether. There's a nice little bit of research looking at people who, again, you can isolate the left or right hemisphere experimentally and ask questions. And when people estimate themselves with their right hemisphere, they're more realistic about themselves. When they estimate themselves with the left hemisphere, they give an unrealistically optimistic assessment of their own skills and abilities compared with what other people would say of them.
If we think about the two hemispheres of the brain, I mean, they've been heavily popularised, left brain, right brain. Yeah. I mean, you suggested that they've been hijacked by management trainers and advertising copywriters and I would add probably New Age aficionados as well.
Indeed. The idea was that, you know, the brain was like a machine that carried out certain functions, and because there were two hemispheres, there was twice as much computing power, as it were, but we would compartmentalise things so that, you know, there was a story that language was in the left hemisphere, reason was in the left hemisphere, and something like creativity and emotion were in the right hemisphere. That's complete and utter misconception of things. Every single brain function is carried out by both hemispheres. Reason and emotion and imagination depend on the coming together of what both hemispheres contribute. So that particular dichotomy is incredibly unhelpful and misleading, and I keep trying to steer away from it, but there is still nonetheless fairly obviously a dichotomy. I mean, I begin by asking the rather simple question, which I'm not aware really that has ever been properly addressed, which is, you know, if the brain is all about making connections, why is it that it's evolved with this whopping divide down the middle?
Interesting question indeed. I mean, nevertheless, even though we now understand that both hemispheres of the brain are involved in all the activities of the brain, you make the case, Ian, that there is quite literally a world of difference between the two hemispheres of the brain.
Yes, that's right, because I think attention is a very interesting thing. It doesn't sound like it, it just sounds like another function of the brain. But in fact, attention is a remarkable thing. It's the nature of attention determines what it is we find. And equally, what we find determines the appropriate kind of attention to pay to it. So there's a reciprocal process.
Your case here is that the left and right hemisphere attend to the world very differently, and so ultimately they construct a different world.
Yeah, well, we do know from lesion studies, from every kind of neuropsychological information, that the left hemisphere tends to adopt a narrowly focused attention, which does bring into focus a very, very small part of the world, and we need that in order to be able to grasp things. The left hemisphere is not, for no reason, the hemisphere that controls for most of us the right hand with which we grasp things and the bits of language which make things precise, whereby we say we grasp something. Mm. So it's about that precision. And in birds and in animals, the left hemisphere focuses on prey or on something that is there to be eaten. And the right hemisphere at the same time is keeping a sort of broad open attention for predators. And we know also that animals and birds use their right hemisphere for social interaction, not just, of course, with foes, but also with kin, with conspecifics. So one of them is a sort of uncommitted and relational mode in which one is looking at the world in a broad sense for whatever it may contain.
That's the right hemisphere.
That's the right hemisphere, and one sees oneself in relation to it. Whereas the left hemisphere takes a very detached and precise view of something that we already know is important. Now, if you put that sort of information together, you end up putting together a lot of little pieces of information, and you get a different sense of what something is from the mind that is able to take a much broader view.
I mean, another way you describe the left hemisphere in the brain is as an ambitious bureaucrat with their own interests at heart, that it's a it's a virtual bloodless affair, parasitic on the right.
Yes, I let rip slightly in that phrase. There's a limit, of course, to how helpful it is to anthropomorphize the hemispheres. On the other hand, I would say there's no obvious reason why comparing them to human beings, after all, each hemisphere is perfectly capable of sustaining consciousness for a human being, there's no reason why then that should be a worse metaphor than the machine metaphor.
Yes, interesting. Psychiatrist and author Ian McGilchrist is my guest this week on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia's All in the Mind. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and we're discussing the battle he thinks is being played out between the two hemispheres of the brain. The stage, no less than the history of civilization as we know it. I mean, let's head back in history, because you look at the present through the lens of the past. What you describe effectively, Ian, is a power struggle that's unfolded over time, over the last 2,000 years, in fact, between the two hemispheres of the brain, that's played out in the formation of Western culture and its key transitions from the ancient Greeks to the present day. So let's dig into that historical narrative. Where does it begin?
Well, I think it probably begins, at least my understanding of it, is that I can see it in the ancient world. And there's a similar progression, actually, in ancient Greece, in ancient Rome, and indeed from the Renaissance onwards in our own world. And that is that, for reasons that are complex and one can only speculate about, there appears to have been a quite sudden shift, an efflorescence of activities that are characteristic of both the best of the right hemisphere and the best of the left hemisphere working together in the 6th century BC in Athens. Mm. And so you get a culture which is enormously productive across the whole field of humanities and science. But as time passes, and by the time the 4th century BC comes along, already there is a drift towards a more theoretical and conceptualized, abstracted, bureaucratic sort of view of the world. And so there's a tendency for things to move further and further towards the left hemisphere's conception. This happens again in ancient Rome. In the Augustan era, there's a brief period when I see the best of the right hemisphere, the best of what the left hemisphere offers together, producing an enormously rich mix which generates what we think of as the bequest of classical Roman culture to our civilization. But again, within a couple of hundred years, things have drifted towards a more unwieldy and bureaucratic, power-hungry, militarized, very hierarchical structure.
Which you sort of describe as a leftward shift in the brain as well.
A leftward shift in
the
brain.
I mean, where does that impulse come from, do you think?
Well, I think it's an inevitable process, which, because of the relationship between the worlds that the right and the left hemisphere produce, that when the left hemisphere is allowed to conceive the world relatively independently from the right hemisphere, which is initially something rather wonderful, as long as it's in conjunction with what the right hemisphere gives, it produces a very rich, productive and fertile and creative, imaginative world.
Because if we think of the ancient Greeks, it was a time of analytical philosophy, but it was also a time of, how you describe it, a sort of greater empathetic engagement with the world.
Yes, it's all the
beginnings. So it sort of had a bit of both, didn't it? The
drama,
abstract and the empathetic.
Absolutely, yes. That's very much to simplify, but we see aspects of what each of them in a specialised way produces, working together, but the right hemisphere contribution seems to decrease and the left hemisphere gains in confidence through its view, which one can see in aspects of Plato's philosophy, that he can account for everything in certain ways. You find Plato eventually saying that astronomy is done by looking inwards, not by looking at the stars, which, you know, is a quite remarkable thing to be saying, only a few hundred years after the first empirical scientists were observing the heavens and making very good and robust deductions from what they saw. So, you know, that's the drift there, and one sees the same thing happening in Roman civilization, and I see this happening also in our civilization when, again, there's this sudden efflorescence of creative life in the sciences and in the arts in the Renaissance. But with the Enlightenment, there's a hardening up of a certain rather dogmatic and left hemisphere-based view of the world, which we're still struggling with.
Are you giving the left hemisphere a bit too much flack here? I mean, you you seem to associate it with an absence of feeling, an absence of depth and context. But on the other hand, I mean, the left hemisphere, you also suggest, lies at the basis of Western civilization. The great push to reason and rationality that was born of the Enlightenment gave birth to modern science.
Well, I slightly dispute that. I think modern science originated in earlier than the Enlightenment, and that's really what I'm saying. There was an enormously rich period in the 15th, 16th and early 17th centuries before the Enlightenment kicked in. And, of course, the left hemisphere is not devoid of feelings at all. It has its own range of emotions and capacity to appreciate emotions. Interestingly, anger is one of the emotions that is most obviously lateralized towards the left hemisphere. So it's not that it's able coolly to get on with science. I think that's a total misconception. The business of
which is a relief. I'm glad it's a misconception.
Yeah, because exactly, science is something much more wonderful than that. Science is patient attention to things as they are, which means actually seeing them in context. And this was very much the spirit in science from Bacon through to Goethe. But there is another strand in which it's become, in a way, decontextualized and dehumanized, which is a mistake, in my view. You say I give the left hemisphere too much flack, and in a way, of course, you're absolutely right. I'm trying to redress a balance, as I keep saying in the book. I mean, nobody needs telling that, you know, rationality is important. It's bloody obvious, really. Nobody needs telling that the capacity to create sequential reasoning is a very important feature of the human mind. But I think because it is so eloquent on its own behalf, it's neglected to allow us to perceive that there are other very important things that need to be combined with it, and that's really the message. It's not that somehow the right hemisphere has got it all right and the left hemisphere has got it all wrong. And that's another either-or, black and white misconception, which is much more typical of the left hemisphere's take on the world. The right hemisphere's take is broadly inclusive. As in the metaphor, the master knows that he needs the emissary. It's the emissary that thinks it doesn't need the master. So my view is the right hemisphere is perfectly aware that it's a symbiotic relationship. And when that works well, as it has done in periods in the West, it's a recipe that can't be beaten. What I say at the end of the book is to speculate as to why this doesn't seem to have happened to the same extent in Oriental cultures.
Yes, that's a very interesting observation.
Yeah.
Because your focus very much is on Western civilization here, isn't it?
Well, it is largely because, of course, that's what I'm familiar with, and it's also the civilization that seems to me to be presenting the world with a crisis at present. But it is interesting that in the last 15 to 20 years, there has been a consistent and growing body of neuropsychological research asking Far Eastern people, Koreans, Chinese and Japanese, to address problems, to make observations, and then comparing them with the same problem-solving strategies and attentional strategies of people of Western extraction. And what one finds there is not that in some sort of new agey way that Oriental peoples are right-hemisphered and we're left-hemisphered. That's another of these rather ridiculous and unhelpful dichotomies. But what one finds is that the Far Eastern peoples are much more able to use, in a balanced way, strategies of either hemisphere, which is how one would hope we would use our brains and minds, whereas there's an enormously skewed distribution for the way in which Westerners look at things. It's very much heavily skewed towards the way of looking at things of the left hemisphere.
I mean, you saw the Romantic era as a great blossoming again of the right hemisphere. But the Industrial Revolution to the present day, for you, represents a major shift leftward in the brain. And of course, we're not saying politically here, we're saying hemispherically
not.
In the brain.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, just describe that shift for us to the present day.
I mean, one of the striking things about the Industrial Revolution is that for the first time, we were able to put into the outside world artifacts which conform very much to the way the left hemisphere sees the world, simple solids that are regular, repeated, not individual, in the way that things that are made by hand are. And to transform the environment, it was a sudden, obviously, move forward in our ability to control our environment and to project outwards onto it the world as conceived inwardly by the left hemisphere. That's gone on into the 20th century, but the interesting thing is that one might think of the Industrial Revolution and scientific materialism, which emerged in the 19th century and are still with us, at least in the biological sciences, although I would say that physics has long moved on from that vision of the world to one that's closer to what both hemispheres see. But that movement is often seen as in opposition to modernist and postmodernist culture. I argue in the book that, in fact, that's not the case, and that modernism and postmodernism are in fact also symptomatic of a shift towards the left hemisphere's conception of the world.
Which is interesting, because I guess the postmodernist view would be that everything exists within a context, and that perhaps there is no absolute truth. And in a sense, I would have thought that contextual framing of the world is more right hemisphere, if your argument is to hold.
Well, of course I agree that things are contextual and there's no absolute truth, but unfortunately in postmodernism this often comes to mean that there is no truth at all. Mm-hmm. There is nothing out there actually beyond the sort of paintings on the wall of the inside of our mind, and that seems to me very much more like what the left hemisphere sees. And in fact the products of the art of modernism and postmodernism bear striking resemblances to what the world looks like to people whose right hemispheres are not working very well. That was something that was first pointed out indirectly by a marvellous book by Louis Sass, American psychologist, who wrote a book called Madness and Modernism, in which he draws extensive parallels between the phenomena of modernism and postmodernism and of schizophrenia. Deficits of the right hemisphere present a world in which the literal triumphs over the metaphorical, things taken out of context triumph over their meaning in a context, particularly a social context. Mm. The sense of connectedness to others, empathy and so forth, is lacking. And the world appears to be a heap of fragments. And one can see this in the sometimes wonderful but bizarre and exotic artistic productions of people with schizophrenia.
You, Ian, do lament the loss of our relationship to beauty, to body, to spirit.
Yep.
And art.
Yep.
Is that to blame on the left hemisphere as well?
Well, again, because its approach is largely reductionist, I think, yes, it doesn't really have the capacity to understand what it's not able to see. There's a rather nice article by Stanley Fish called Does Reason Know What Reason Doesn't Know? Which I think is a good point. The problem really in essence is that the left hemisphere is not aware of what it is not aware of, in that sort of rather Rumsfeld-like formula. But, you know, that's what gives it a sort of confidence which one can anthropomorphise as a sort of an arrogant stance. And that's the difficulty that we face, is getting a hearing at all for what the right hemisphere has to say.
But clearly you're at risk of further dichotomising between left and right hemispheres in the brain, in the way that all the sort of popular mythologies about the hemispheres would have us believe.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly beauty, the body, the spirit, art, emotion aren't purely the domains of the right hemisphere.
They certainly aren't, and both are contributed to by both hemispheres, absolutely. But at the moment what I think is that a rather reductionist version of what they might be is evident not just in science but in a popular culture, and indeed is expressed in the kind of art that's created nowadays too. So I think a lot of the power of art to alert us to things beyond ourselves, of yes, what is known as the transcendent, I think that has been lost. There's a sort of ironizing undercutting of the power of beauty, the power of art, the power of the spirit. I don't want to sound evangelical here, but these things are important and need to be mentioned. You know, a lot of very great scientists have always said that these things are an important part of what science acknowledges and pays tribute to. So, you know, I'm hopeful that the synthesis that I consider would be fruitful can be re-established. At the moment, things seem to be very skewed.
Well, Ian McGilchrist, it's a grand, provocative, epic and enticing thesis, and thank you for joining me on the programme
this
week.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Ian McGilchrist there, calling for a peace agreement, a reunion in the hemispheric battleground of the brain. His vast book is called The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World, published by Yale University Press. Details the audio and transcript on the All in the Mind website. And look for add your comment on this week's story page to be part of the discussion, or on my blog, where I've added lots of extra audio from our interview together. Get to that via abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Next week, a raw telling of grief, love and intimacy.
On the Law Report, outlaw bikie gangs score a big legal win against the South Australian government. The High Court strikes down laws preventing gang members from associating with each other. Also, the case of the three men who burst into a flat, one wielding a sword, another a gun. The man with the gun shoots dead one of the occupants. So can the man with the sword also be found guilty of murder? That's on the Law Report with me, Damien Carrick, and you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.